for instance, regarding the need for a collective name, even not related to a formal organization. I'm speaking today as a member of the Eurolinux Alliance, which is an informal alliance. Basically, it's a mailing list, which is the best way we have found to forward information to the group quickly across all European countries. So it's an alliance of individuals, associations and companies which fights against the implementation of software patents in Europe. So it's very focused in goal. We have started actions several years ago, and in particular, we have one of the largest online petitions, at least in the European side. And so we have more than 150,000 signatories against software patents in Europe, among which we find more than 2,000 CEOs and CTOs of software companies, most of which are from the proprietary software field. And we have not been, I think, so fortunate with the name, because the name heavily relates to Linux, but what we try to sell to the people we lobby is the fact that the problem of software patents is not related to the Libre Free Software, even if Libre Free Software is going to be harmed much by the Software Patent Directive. But the problem is orthogonal, and our main argument is that software patents harm SMEs, as I will try to show you afterwards, and SMEs which do proprietary software as well, and they represent 70% of the wealth of jobs and jobs produced in Europe. Although these figures can be, I would say, discussed with respect to LibSoftware, because LibSoftware is not accounted for in terms of value in these reports and these governmental economic studies. Anyway, so the name is historical and we have to cope with it. So, by explaining people longer maybe they can figure out what the company is. Yes, absolutely, yes, sorry. SMEs means small and medium enterprises, yes. you do hear a basic work of explanation and pre-lobbying. That means to give you arguments to see how software patterns are evil and how in turn you can forward this information to also your relatives, and if you are the nephew of some member of parliament or minister in some of the countries, well, please do and contact us. Patents exist only because they have a social utility. I mean, they were designed in the beginning of the industrial era to stimulate the innovation by guaranteeing innovators a remuneration which was either a leading position in their respective markets. So this is the notion of monopoly by law of the patent. And if the owner of the patent decides to license, he can get licensing fees which compensate for the right of use by third parties. But if you think from the individual's point of view, patents are lost of entrepreneurship and of individual freedoms. And so it is socially useful only if the benefit induced by loss of freedom favors innovation and the whole for all of the society. And so they were not designed for the sole pleasure of jurists. This is why this is an arrow that I throw to some jurists of the European Commission that much too pleased to play, I mean, with such paperwork and create more and more things they can work on. So any new patent regulation should prove not even a social benefit before being accepted. In Europe, computer programs, considered as works of the mind, are protected by copyright. It's droit d'auteur in France, but it's a feeble droit d'auteur where there are no moral rights, so it's pretty much like copyright. And so this has been restated less than 15 years ago by the European Directive number 91/2015. Also, software is explicitly excluded from patentability by Article 52 of the 1973 European Patent Convention, called the Convention of Munich, as well as games and mathematics, which are considered as being non-industrial and non-technical. However, when writing the text, they put a limitation fixation, the exclusion, which is that this exclusion from patentability is limited to software as such. And this is also fuzzy words that lawyers can bend in any way. The basic idea of the proponents of the text was that even at their time, more and more devices began to implement some functionalities in terms of software, when you had prior to that only hardware devices. If you think of a gearbox for a car, an automatic gearbox, in the beginning it was only hydraulic and mechanical, and then there was some computerization, and some of the functionalities that were beforehand implemented by hardware were then implemented by software. And so the idea of the proponents of the text was to say, okay, a new gearbox with some functionalities can be patented because it's a hardware device, it's an invention, it's a technical solution to a technical problem. But if you look at it as a system, you can patent it. And when you consider the software as such, there's a software that is within the device, it's a work of the mind, it's mathematics, so it should not be part of the scope of the patent claims. So this is for us the meaning of the as such. In fact, some of the European patent offices have had a strange interpretation of the as such. In fact, patent offices began to grant patents for purely intellectual methods written in some technical jargon referring to a technical apparatus using a computer, etc., and saying that in fact, yes, if software as such was not patentable, software within these technical devices was technical, and so it was not software as such unless it was patentable. And so, some European patents are very interesting because these are already granted patents. And for instance, the progress bar, on any single program, you have a progress bar. Well, it's patented. And so, if you run a program, and you run a progress bar on your computer, you're an infringer. And you should pay something to IBM. If you run, because it's a process that you patent. This is very interesting. It's the notion that the final infringer is the user. We'll deal with that afterwards, too. One of them is also very interesting. It's what call up your business method patterns. I mean, a patent on a way of making, doing commerce. It patterns the fact of distributing cooking recipes in supermarkets in order to increase the sales of ingredients. And so it has been granted because it's made of a computer and a printer, and it's highly technical. There is also another system for testing pupils by means of computers. It's patented. You should not do that. If you write a program, with a web page and the checkbox things, it's you're infringing. And moreover, your pupils are infringing. You're right. You're right. Good. Yuff. Moreover, Bandai also has been able to patent the Tamagotchi. And it's not on the device itself, because it's a game also. But their patent is on the claim, the right on the process of fostering a virtual creature. Highly technical. What we can experience here in the past years and the current years, and what I'm going to conclude my talk with, is that we have now a global drifting towards a dramatic increase of the notion of property and privatization. And in the USA, for instance, the USPTO had no such provisions to exclude software, genes, or plants, or whatever you want. So the doctrine that has been restated recently by the Mr. Rogan from the US Patent Trademark Office is everything man makes under the sun is patentable. And in fact, in the United States, there are really funny patents. I had one in another slideshow. If you play with a laser pointer and you use it just and your cat chases the spell of light, it's patented. have it if you want for people who want to go to the US database. I have it. It's for Ilya, and there's a drawing. You see that really the man is not going to make a single move to have fun with his cat, but just anyway, let's think in terms of regulations and the way regulations can help foster innovation. The scope of copyright is that copyright guarantees that no one can copy a program in order to give it or sell it if you have not allowed him to. He cannot even try to modify it. I say try to because if you want to fix a bug in Windows Access, well, you can try, but you are not even allowed to do that. Or even use it beyond the codes specified by its license. However, and this is the main problem for some major companies in software programming, copyright does not forbid anyone from writing a new program with similar features which is compatible with the input and output formats of the original program, and which is basically interoperable with the original program, even in terms of access protocols. For instance, I would like to go to and interact with .NET or whatever you want. Well, copyright does not prevent that. And so basically you can still write programs that can compete on the same market. But when you think about software patents protect against imitation, not copy. Imitation. That is, when you patent a program, you're not patenting the program as such as the works of the mind. You're putting a hand on what the program does, the underlying concepts of the program. And so what you protect is what the program does, that is what concrete problem the program solves, that is what business method it implements, because it's a way of algorithms. A matter of algorithms of real life, or mathematical algorithms. Basically, they're the same. And also, who does it, and more specifically, what input-output data it handles, and how it interacts with other programs, I mean protocols and APIs. And what is important is that data formats, algorithms, business methods are logically inseparable, because you can still build an algorithm that creates some data format. And this is why, for instance, Microsoft patented its new media player format. It's because then it monopolizes any algorithm that writes such data. And for instance, with MP3, there has been much fuss about the MP3 because of content copying. But the MP3 format itself is patented. It's a form of a patent and the rights are owned by Thomson Multimedia. And so, until recently, there could be no free MP3 encoder because the license of Thomson was to say that you had to pay in order to create programs that encode MP3 streams. Recently, they changed the license. And now even to decode, you have to get a license. You can see mp3licensing.com, you will see the fees and you have to pay anyway. So, now software patents are going to Europe. And there is a European Commission directive proposal currently at stake, and which has been claimed to be motivated by very interesting arguments. The first one was Europe must harmonize with US policies. Okay, we're a large market, and the more with the 10 countries that are going to join us, but anyway, we should do the same. Oh. So, this is more an excuse than an argument, and anyway, this is not going to be in the writing of the law, because big businesses that push software patents don't want a business method patents because their own businesses could be sued very simply. And so they want in the text to avoid explicitly business method patents. But as I showed you before, in reality, even with these provisions, business methods can be granted if you monopolize the algorithm of doing the business. So, anyway, in the text, there should be differences, so this argument does not hold much. The other argument that we've heard is that one must clarify the law and harmonize at the European Union level, which is a bit awkward because the European Patent Convention of 1973 already harmonized things. Software was not patentable within all of the Union, And it's the some of the patent offices, and mainly the European Patent Office, which broke the harmonization by granting more than 30,000 purely software patents, and then wanted to cover this misbehavior, and which is currently in contradiction with the current written law. The third argument, which in fact goes to the history of the patent system itself, is that patents finance innovation. Oh, good. But this argument is sound, as it absolutely understandable, but it should be investigated on a scientific basis rather than a religious basis. Patents do promote innovation. If you don't think so, you'll be burned, you'll be crucified. And, we have to discuss the fact. And then, first problem for the pro-patent lobby. This is the third argument that you can oppose to them. Okay, is that so great? Show me a study. And none of all of the economy studies that have been carried out to measure the benefit of software patents in the USA, as well as in Europe, where software patents have a semi-existence, yielded a positive result. It is sure that if there had been one, it is sure that the pro-software patent lobby would have done maximum advertising with it. And from our point of view, it would have been much harder to discuss the viability of software patentability if the economy would have been against us. But it's not the case. Moreover, there has been a most recent study dating back just from May 2003, which the authors of which are Jim Besson from the MIT and Hunt from the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, which are absolutely not Trotskyist free software lovers. I mean, these are most serious and suit wearing guys. And they studied more than 130 1,000 software patents granted in the United States from 1976 to now, and studied also the financial reports of more than 1,600 software companies in the United States. And the conclusion they reached is that in the USA, software patent expenses substituted from 10 to 15% of R&D spendings. That is, it's a huge burden. I mean, they vaporize huge sums of money just to feed a bunch of people that have nothing to do about innovation. And you have some links, the slides will be available, so don't crush your eyes trying to look the small printing on the bottom. You'll be able to have it afterwards. So, our opinion when looking at this is that the patent system has been designed for the material economy of the past centuries. What I say, in order to have a one-liner, is that you do not pair a rocket with a steam engine. Because the economy of intangibles is very different, and it's especially for software. First, you have an almost zero marginal cost, that is the cost of producing one additional unit of your software is almost zero. Once you have made the original investment of producing the prototype, you have the final product, which is absolutely not the case in the traditional industry. If you think of the assembly lines for cars and such devices, you have an additional cost for every unit you produce. For software, you can even share the cost with the users. I mean, they can just pay for the bandwidth to get the software. I mean, there can be many distribution models because of this. Second, it's a fairly low investment apart from brains. I mean, some software take a long time to develop, but you don't have to have a research facilities and many things. I mean, even my laptop, I can write a software that will run on a supercomputer. It's not the point of having a powerful machine. It's the point of having powerful brains to turn good ideas into good software. Then, they are highly complex products. I mean, no programmer now can master the whole development of software. You need to rely on a whole bunch of third-party libraries and modules for handling databases, graphics, system, communication, stack, whatever you want. So, if you put barriers to market entry on each of these products, then you kill the whole software development because you put an economical them that is so high that the final value of the product you will have to sell will have no relation to the effort, just the effort you make to create the software. So it's completely it distorts the market. Fourth, in software you have extremely strong network externalities. The notion of network externalities is that the more people use the software, the more value the software has, because you share the same data formats. If you have the same software as your neighbor, you can share easily files with him, so you create a network which is stronger. And the more you have people, the stronger your network is, and the stronger you are with respect to potential competitors. And this is absolutely what Microsoft did when it being pirated by Africa and by Asia, because then people created for their companies, for their homes, lots of files into proprietary formats. And then when the lawyer comes, when the BSA comes with the big stick, you have to stay with them and you have to pay, because else the burden of turning these proprietary data formats you know nothing about into another competitor's format is too high. And this is why also it's very important to be able to monopolize file formats, which you cannot do with copyright, but which you can do with patents. It's because then if you patent the format, you will prevent anyone from writing a program that would translate these file formats into another file format. And then you lock your users into your system. Just to sum up things, if you think about software development, well, it consists in having some problem solution ideas. Here you have the notion of technical solution to technical problem, but it's a matter of ideas just. So these ideas are suitable to whole problem spaces, that is, if you monopolize the idea, you monopolize the problem space from an economical point of view. And so you are here in a full analogy with business methods. And it's also the cheapest part of the innovation, if you think about it. I mean, basic ideas you can have while taking your shower in the morning. However, the important effort when designing, when turning these ideas into software is the coding part. Because first, one point is that there exist very few different algorithms to solve the same problem. That is, if you monopolize also the algorithm, people hardly can escape and find another algorithm in order to do the same thing. And moreover, this is for the software companies the most expensive and error-prone part. That is, this is here where the cost of software is. And so, if you want to prevent a pirate from getting all of your investment, for him, you just have to work on a regulation at the copying level. Here, if you want to prevent imitators and improvers, then you have here to protect the ID. And so to have patents. But if you have patent, then you also prevent improvers, so you limit competition and you limit further innovation. So regulations should reward innovation efforts while preserving competition. And so let's think about software patents. What patent attorneys try to sell you is this. This is your wonderful software, made of all small blocks, and you have your genius guy sign here, please. You have something that can be patented. It would be very, very expensive, just a few tens of thousands of euros, and you will be a happy guy. And you will get much, much revenue from your patent. If you look at the economical equation for software, here's the basic equation without patents. Your profit is your sales minus the development cost. And you add new variables to your function. It's the revenue you expect from your patent minus the cost of enforcing your patent, which is the first filing cost plus the renewal of your patent. But the reality is much more closer than a dancing blinded in a minefield. Because, in fact, most of the techniques that you think are not worth patenting are indeed already patented. And so, in your equation, there is a third parameter that has been added, which is the cost of infringement. first, you have to consider that anyway, this is a negative sum game. That is, on the whole, patterns are just a way to move money from one player to another player. The idea is that it should favor innovation if the money goes to the guy that innovates in order for him to get further innovations. And Rambos for me is innovation cost. But is it really the case? That is, you have a cost for the system, but is it really worth a game? If you look at this equation and just consider it for entities that are members of this playing field. If you're a small publisher, you have absolutely no way to get revenue from your patent, because if you want to say, please, Mr. IBM, I have a patent, I think you infringed. The IBM lawyers turn to you and say, okay, guy, we have 10,000 patents. Okay, one, okay. Done. We have 9,999 patents, so it's 5% of your gross, then else boom. I'm not joking. This is a real case. I will show you the links for afterwards. So you won't get money from the system, and also you may be sued at any moment, because if you're competitive enough and you bug the big players, they have the stockpile of patents and they send them to you. And it has been evaluated that the per side cost of a lawsuit infringement for patents is above $1 million. So when you're an SME, you can almost hardly swallow one, but maybe not two, not even three. It's in the United States. In Europe, the legal costs are lower, but the lawyers' costs are basically the same, considering the living standards. I mean, they're expensive. If you're a large publisher, the situation is completely different. Even if you don't expect to get revenue from your patents, only a few of them have the aggressive behavior of extorting revenues from these patents, like IBM, for instance. But even if you don't get money from your own patents, you are in a portfolio building strategy which neutralizes competitors' patterns. One of the most significant cases has been the Adobe versus Macromedia trial. First, one of them, I don't know which one, it's not relevant. One of them sued the other for infringing on one crappy patent. So the other one countersued, saying, oh, I have another crappy patent. Boom, X. Fight. And then, the lawyers, which are really intelligent people, say, okay, if we go to court, the court will nullify both of our patents and we'll get nothing at the end. Much of money will have been wasted and we may even be fired for inefficiency. So let's make a deal. We mutually recognize the validity of our respective patents. And then we make an agreement that we put our patents in a portfolio and say that we won't use them against the other. So if you look that from an economical point of view, large publishers manage to live in a world without patents. And they use only these patents to shoot down the small players that would want a piece of the cake. Another player is interesting. Here are the mosquitoes, the piranhas. These are patent firms. Basically, there are bunches of lawyers that consider software patents as venture capital. They buy cheap patents and try to get money out of them. And so they don't produce software, so they will have no cost in infringement. And so even the big players will begin to fear them, because when you're a big player, you have always something to trade with a small player. But with them, you have nothing. The more you give them, the more they want. And so they have patents and they try to sue people. First, they sue the little ones. For instance, there are in the United States many crappy patents on e-commerce. And for instance, if you have a window, you know, on a web page, you have buttons on the left, and if you click, it changes the contents on the right. It's patented. You would call that frames, but they call that patent infringement. And so they're charging, they're suing people for that, but car mechanics, flower shops, and in the small ones that will in any case not be able to go to court. can attack larger and larger and larger players. And now even Microsoft is going to have trouble with those nasty pyramids. So who survives? Large companies? Well, some of them, only the really, really, really big ones. Because they share patent portfolios which neutralize each other, and they are now in a quasi-monopoly position. And it's interesting because the whole goal of patents for them is to turn a monopoly of fact into a monopoly of law, which will never be challenged again. The patent firms and small companies willing to be bought, because the value of such companies which own wonderful patents is evaluated by patent attorneys, which talk to the patent attorneys of the other company willing to buy the company, and they play cards, you know, baseball cards. Oh, yeah, you have this one, okay, it's worth, this one plus two marbles, and so, and they get a share, I mean, they get a percentage, so these companies are really worth bunches of bucks. First, there is no personal desire for certain innovation because they sell the company, so they have no interest in it and in its future behavior. But which is interesting is that this bargaining value has no economical sense. It is part of the splitting of the internet bubble. I mean, companies, valuable companies, are companies that turn good ideas into good software. If you have just patents in where I'm worth $1 zillion because I own these patents and I have a monopoly on everything, and you're not able to turn that into real code, then you die. And this is really what happened in the internet era. I mean, all of these companies were overestimated, and software patents had a role in that respect. So who with us? Well, small software publishers, generally poorly prepared for legal battles, because of lack of funds, lack of adapted juridical competence, lack of patent portfolios to share, and also companies that use in-house software to solve their business problems, even if they do not belong to the software industry, and even if they do not sell their software, they use it for an industrial purpose, say the infringers. And also the Lehman Open Source software developers, because since you provide source code to the attacking party, you make really easy the proof of patent infringement, because else if you're living in a world of proprietary closed software, you have to prove infringement by decompilation, which is prohibited. So you have to delocalize to some countries. For instance, in Japan, decompilation is legal, except for American programs. Don't ask me about that. I think it's a matter of history. Just a few quotes. It's the pose. Neuronal pose. This is a general counsel from IBM. It's very clear. You say you get value from patents in two ways. Well, through fees, okay. But through licensing negotiations that give IBM access to other patents. So the IBM portfolio gives us access to the inventions of others. He says there's no direct calculation of this value, but it's many times larger than the fee income, perhaps an order of magnitude larger. It says IBM rates more than $2 billion from its active patents in the past years. I mean, it's a yearly income. So you can see the value of being able to draw a large gun to the face of every SME you want the technology of, and negotiate. And so the aggressive use of IBM by IBM of its patent portfolio is known as, in the Silicon Valley, as the IBM tax. And so, there's a paper in Forbes, which is not a left-wing journal. Legal counsel from Sun Microsystems spoke and told who IBM lawyers came and asked Sun $2 million on the basis of 7 Euclidean geometry patents. You have a line, poof, 4 points. It's a rectangle. Oh, it's patented. So you have a bunch, a lot of links, and one is very interesting. It's You May Be Next. The name is explicit. So think about the W3C. There has been a huge fight, a great struggle, because some of the players of the W3C, like Microsoft, for instance, wanted the W3C to adopt a policy where it could adopt as standards, patented standards. So the idea was to wipe out all of the lib software from the internet, because these patents would have been available through a reasonable and non-discriminatory basis. That is, if you're IBM and if you're a lib software developer, you have to pay the same. It's non-discriminatory. So for the W3C, we have been able, I think, to fight back enough. But it's, you know, such incentives are very silent, and we only discover them too often when it's too late. Well, just a thing to say that it's always claimed that we need patents because investors want patents in order to put capital into the companies. Well, the idea is exactly the opposite. If you don't have patents, the investor is sure that the money he would have put in the company will be turned into software, and that he will be able to see that software sold to get his money back. With software patents, he will have his money put into the software and turned into software, but he can be sued at any time if he wants to market his software. So he is less certain to have return on his investment in a system of software patents than without. So this is a point that must be made. Moreover, if an investor thinks that a patent is a mark of excellence, then he should not be an investor, and his money should be given to someone else, because indeed it's said in the text of the EPO itself. In itself, it says patents are not a stamp of excellence. And if you look at the copy patents they granted, it's absolutely true. Think also about patent examination quality. Some people say, yes, but it's implementation problems with more qualified patent examiners and longer examination procedures, then it would be better, so we must keep software patents. At the time being, the EPO has a 6+ year backlog. That is, the patents you file now will only be granted, if ever, they will be, 6 years after. And the average software products is on average 18 months. Even if you think about the Windows, it was 95, 95 and such, 98, 98 release 2, Millennium Edition, IXP. When you look at it, even for Microsoft, they are able to put a product every 2 years and get money back from it. That is, if that were not the case, they would go bankrupt. They don't. So it means that in 18 or 24 months, you are able to get your money back from the market. And consider that patents are granted only 6 years afterwards. It means that patents are not necessary to get revenue from your innovations. And anyway, they're granted too late. It means that they are nonsense from the innovation protection point of view. The only way you get money from patents is that if you are able to patent a technique that is so broad that it will go on being used 20 years afterwards, so that you must, as you can write as much money as possible from your original investment. So this is why, by nature, software patents are trivial. Because the more trivial they are, the more broad they are, and so the more money you can get from them. So software developers have no benefit in using money in development and advertising than in patents. Say for purposes of anti-competition, we've seen that it has nothing to do with respect to innovation, so it's an anti-competition tool. And also tax evasion. This one is great. This is based on the fact that in some countries, patent royalties, patent fees, are not taxable. And for instance, in Ireland, and this is maybe this is a hint on why there are so many software companies and American subsidies in Ireland. It's a three-step dance. First, you file patent and you get patent in a country where royalties are not taxable, and also in other countries. Then, if you have some subsidies that you don't want the profits to be taxed, you license this patent to them. And so, all the money they pay you as licenses is deducted from their revenues, and so they end up with a zero income, and so they're not taxed. And all the money you get from the fees in a country where it's not taxable, It's not taxable. It's patent fees. Oh, great. So, indeed, when you're running a patent attorney business, you could not do that with, hydraulic pumps. I mean, say, you cannot license hydraulic pumps patents to your subsidy. But with software patents, you can patent anything. Say, patent the way of stamping at the bottom of the page. And if someone is willing to pay for that, okay, we license the patent. And so, it's gone. Well, some people say, yes, in order to protect SMEs, we'll do something great. We're going to do software patent insurances. Because they can't afford the cost, well, they pay an insurance and the insurance will pay the cost for them. Really serious people from the World Bank, you know, did this stuff for serious guys, purpose that. I smoke too much. And so, well, you can by yourself find the proper counter arguments just to bash this sort of rubbish. But anyway, it has been proposed. I mean, when Denmark was in charge of the presidency of the European Union and they had to handle the software patent directive case, they proposed that. So, that's fun. A few words about the European Patent Office. Well, it's completely flawed. It's an opaque, out of control organization. First, it's the only international organization I know which makes profit. Most of them are sinks for taxpayers' money, but this one is making profit. And since it's international, it is not taxable, it has no social rules with respect to the working conditions of its workers, and even the head of the European Patent Office has the rank of an ambassador. And he's immune to legislation. And so once in, I think it was 1985, he bit one of his employees. And he could not go to trial because the administration council refused to lift his immunity. You have a page, it has been pushed out of the internet, but it's still on cache in Google. It's the Workers Union of the European Patent Office. They recall the story, you can have more detail from them. So, This organization is entirely funded by patent applications and renewal fees. More of them, it's not a European Union organization, because in addition to the member states, it has Liechtenstein, Switzerland, Cyprus, maybe Andorra, things like that, those very important industrial states that make that it cannot be an EU-controlled organization. And all of these countries have one vote, yes? They keep it. You could see the offices wonderful. I mean, you can swim in the carpets. For the bosses, I mean, if you're an examinator, maybe, the chair cramps and so it's not the same. Yeah. Yeah. Basically. So more patents means more power and more money, irrespective of public good. Moreover, there is a concentration that is 7% of the applicants have more than 50% of the patents. And so one could ask the question that is, what is the real power of these largest customers? And I really speak about customers, that is, I'm not speaking about users with respect to a public service. I'm explicitly speaking about customers in a profit-making business. The profit rate was 20% for year 198, which was an amount of 150 million euros of profit. Moreover, it's really funny in terms of legislation, because it is its own board of appeal. So there are technical boards and technical appeal boards, which are all part of the European Patent Office. And for instance, IBM was debunked on some at first when submitting software patents, but IBM went to appeal courts within the EPO, and at last they got their patent granted, and moreover, this served as jurisprudence in order to change the rules of patentability of the European Patent Office. You can see all of this on the FFIA webpage. I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. I'm here on the side of Sirius. I could wear a tie. I should button the appeal. Yeah. What? I'd be even bolder because it's the point. Screwing people. A problem is screwing people. Well, you know, this doesn't count with the appeal. Sorry? Gosh. They're smart guys. They don't want to be run out of business. So, what are the major issues we're discussing about? First, it's the problem of seizing and nationalizing of concepts. I mean, the threat has been moving upwards from the basic material things up to now intellectual objects. I mean, business methods, educational methods, ideas. There is the problem of interoperability, that is, we are about to go back 30 years in time. It's also the problem of the existence of free competition. If I look at it from a European point of view, since I'm a European and I'm acting at the European level, it's also a matter of software independence of Europe with respect to the United States, mainly because most of the providers of software regarding operating systems and business suits are not multinational companies. But Microsoft and IBM are first of all American companies, and it's no surprise that the Bush administration, which is so paranoid about security and control over the whole planet, let Microsoft go alone, because you, in their opinion, it would be completely stupid to break the tool that lets you enter 80% of the computers on the planet. And there are two interesting links here. The first one deals with the NSA key into Windows. And the second one is really interesting. It's about the security flaws in Lotus Notes. In Lotus Notes, in the export versions, when you unciphered the documents with the 64-bit keys, which is no joke, but at the time being that was a matter of serious things. In fact, 40 of the bits of your keys were also encoded with a public key and added to the document. And the private key of this public key was in the NSA. It means that if the NSA wanted to get a hand on your document, it just needed to use its private key to get 40 bits of the key and just crunch the 24 remaining bits in a matter of seconds. But I mean, it's only politeness. They could have just put the 64 bits of the key and ciphered them, but then people would have reacted differently. It's just a matter of softness. And the last one is interesting also. It's a French general opening his mouth. This is so rare, you know, that it should be noted. He is the head of the French Military School of Transmission. That is, it's the school that is the purpose of which is to train the cryptographist and the transmission officers in the French army. And where some of it was interesting because he said, well, we've been dealing with the length of the keys, but it's no use having a steel-plated door when your wall is plaster. That is, if you have a 2 zillion bits at a key, you have it on your computer disk. And so if someone can just put a hand in your computer and get the private key, what's the matter of having so long a key? And so his statement is that one of the only solutions for Europe to have an independent information technology industry was to rely on Libre software, because if you think about operating systems, for instance, no business would be able to launch the project of building an alternate operating system thinking that it could commercially gain shares in the market with all the network effects of Windows. But we have one. It's BSD, Linux, so we have made plenty of them. And since commuted. Well, it's already paid for in some sense. It would be stupid not to use it. So patterns can be seen as a strategic weapon with respect to the current policy of the United States administration. Well, most of the administrations, even in Clinton's era, it was the same thing, because it's always the same people in common, whatever the people on top of the executive are. And so it's an offensive used of the patent system in order to control new fields consider strategy. It's easy, since the US Patent Office patents everything. Even if you don't invent them, you can patent it. Because you have the right to patent it. While in other countries you need a specific legislation in order to turn and to broaden the scope of patentability. Then you make international pressures on organizations that are absolutely not democratic. I mean the World Trade Organization, the World Intellectual Property Organization are bodies that have a tremendous power considering the fact that they have no political control. And then, with this, you get global control of innovation, because there is something in the patent system which is priority dates. And since all of these patents have been filed in the United States prior to all of the others, then they gain anteriority, and so they come into force. And moreover, maybe that would look very paranoid, but recently there has been the negotiation of a new patent law treaty under the auspices of the WIPO. And the American delegation is pushing for unlimited patentability. That is, they want to remove in the world patent law the necessity to have the patented object to be a technical solution to a technical problem. They want to remove the notion of technicity so that they can patent everything, the laser beam and the cat. And even the threatened to walk out of the negotiations if their demands were not met. And so you can find the proceedings of all of the sessions in these documents. You know, it's the site of the WIPO. I mean, it's not anarchist online, and it's their own documents. You just have to read them. So you can see that also. An and progress. The United States and the Germany, Jordan, Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, signed a convention regarding intellectual property. Note that Jordan is not a major software producer, not a major software consumer, but it badly needs the United States. And so, it is most likely to sign this sort of texts. And you see that Jordan shall take all steps necessary to clarify the exclusion from pattern production of mathematical methods does not include such methods such as business methods or computer-related inventions. Because once Jordan has signed, once Morocco has signed, all of these will count one vote in WIPO and further negotiations. However, the message that I want to deliver to the European members of the Parliament, the European lawmakers, is that we can choose to have software patents as well as not to have them. Because, for instance, one of the arguments is TRIPS requires that all patents be granted for all fields of technology. Okay, software is a work of the mind, it's not technology. It's intellectual creation, yes? Trade-related... convention that is being signed into under the auspices of the World Trade Organization. You know, the things that our governments keep signing and absolutely not telling us about. Yeah. Yeah. Basically, it's the same crap, I mean. So this is a political decision, and it's very important because at the time being in Europe, it's the first occasion an elected body has the occasion to vote on that aspect. It is very interesting because many countries are looking the undergoing process, and even the United States, there have been recently Federal Trade Commission hearings in which the heads of Boland of small companies that make profit from software patents say we don't want them, it's crap because our engineers don't know how to handle them. We don't know how to handle them. They're useless and they cost much. And so It would be very surprising that at a time where the United States itself wants to get rid, some of the base, the workers, not the patent attorneys that we want to keep them, but the basis of the economical ground, the economic structure, wants to survive and wants to get rid of software patents, we implement them in Europe as a proof of modernity, as good followers of the United States. So the recent events, I'm just going to be short because I only have 5 minutes left. There was an online consultation prior to the drafting of the directive. An online consultation was launched at the end of the year 2000 by the General Directorate of the Internal Market of the European Commission, which was a fully opaque consultation based on a biased report. The report was written by one economist and two patent attorneys. The economist said in the middle of the report, there is no evidence that software patents help any innovation in any way. And so the patent attorneys wrote the abstract and the conclusion, says, so we must have them. You know, as in many administrations, people only read the abstract and the conclusion. So this is why the patent attorneys were here for. And so they got more than 1,500 answers. 104,000 were against, coming from the people that deal with software, and 100 answers were coming from large companies, the lawyers of these companies, which is rather different because they play their own game. Even for them, more litigation means more power, even if it wrecks the company. And info dated organizations, so the well-known and famous unis and ACTA lobbies, which in fact are handled by the same lawyers from the same companies, but you know, it's ECHO, it makes things more important. And so very feeble representation of independent SMEs, which are in fact the main targets of the directive, so they should have been consulted more directly, they should have been informed. They were not. And so the analysis by an independent consulting contractor, which I hope has not been paid too much, is the matter is political. Oh, good. Because the conclusion of the commission was, the 1,400 are just the people that know nothing about it, so don't count their votes and don't listen to their opinions. In fact, regarding the draft of the directive, which has been made public by the European Commission on February 20, 2002, we got a hand on a draft file of the directive. It was a doc file, it has a signature inside it, and the signature was the one of Francisco Mingorance, which is the European lobbyist for the Business Software Alliance. So I came to the MEPs. I was already in contact with and say, hey, look, this is Carlos. You say, well, it happens every day. I mean, most of the texts that come onto the desk of the commission in order for them to be drafted as directive are written by lobbies. So, well, it's not surprising. Okay. Well, just trying to be a good citizen. And in the European Parliament, which is the body into which we have the more chance of winning, I mean, because it's the less prone to lobbying and corruption, that the process is rather complicated. There are two committees for opinion, which were in this case a committee for culture and committee for industry, which seems no more considering the impact of the text. But the committee which writes the final report is the juridical committee, the Committee for Legal Affairs. And moreover, there's a final vote in plenary session. The Culture and Industry Committees took position against software patentability in very clear words. Former French Prime Minister Michel Rocard is head of the Culture Committee, and he wrote a wonderful report you can get from the links here. I think it's the first one, it's the 488, etc. You can have a look at it. It's very insightful. I mean, he got the idea. He got the point. However, in spite of this, the Legal Affairs Committee took position in favor of complete software patentability, which is not really surprising because it has a long record, as I've been told by European friends. Friends of the work in the commission, that the juridical committee has always been following the lobbies, and so even for the tobacco advertising campaign, they removed all the restrictions to tobacco advertising, which were put back in plenary. So, in fact, their vote is not so important, the main vote is in plenary. The reporter for the Populist Party group within the Juridical Commission is Janine Fourtou. She's the wife of Janine Fourtou, who is the CEO of Vivendi Universal. And Italian Vice President of the Commission is Mr. Gargani, who is the lawyer of Berlusconi. So the next round will be in plenary. Just a thing about this, we saw that infringers were people who actually ran the software. But with them they were not happy because they could not sue the makers of the software. So they added some articles which said that you could also claim an invention on any medium or carrier. That is, if you have in your pocket a diskette or a CD-ROM in which you have an algorithm that is patented, then you are an infringer. You can be sued. So everybody is an infringer. Yeah, let's all go and hide somewhere. So, first the directive had to be voted in plenary on September the 1st, but following the vote in the Juridical Commission, Arlene McCarthy, who is the head of the Juridical Commission regarding the statute, she's the rapporteur, just made intense pressures to have it voted on June the 30th, just in order to, for the MEPs, for the whole bunch of the MEPs who are not aware of the issues, so, just for them not to be informed by us. And thanks to also intense pressures in the other side, we could have put it back to the September the 1st. But the MEPs will be on holidays for most of the time, so it will be hard anyway. However, some papers appeared in the newspapers. It's a recent event, so well, let's see. What I want to do in 2 minutes left is that there are many other texts that are being drafted at the very same time by the very same lobby and which harm us as citizens. We have seen the DMCA, we have seen the drafting of the SSSCA in the United States regarding TCPA Palladium. There are software patents. There is a new text on enforcement on yes, enforcement of whatever you think, it's a piracy. And IP enforcement, okay. Also the same message for two. Yes, my best friend. Conventions, international conventions, And this one is a convention on jurisdiction and foreign judgments in civil and civil and commercial matters. And you have several articles which allow any company to choose the court they want in order to rule litigation. So if in Azerbaijan there is no consumer rights, maybe they will sell you your software with a clickable contract stating that every litigation will be run in the state of Azerbaijan. And if you're a single citizen, and if you don't have the money just to pay a translator into whatever language, whatever tongue it is, too bad for you. And there's an Article 12 on patents. And in fact, it says that when some state grants patents, then they are legal in any other state. So it's just a way to bypass every regulation and restriction member states can put in their own national or transnational legislation. And this piece of crap is also on its way. Well, okay. So, I will conclude on this. We are now living in a state that I will call a state of intellectual property crisis. It's a frenzy where property rights are being redefined from societal compromise in terms of economic improvement, and creation of wealth, into national absolute rights, I would say feudal rights. And so intellectual property is now seen as an end rather than a mean. That is, you have no intellectual property based businesses. We have seen also restrictive reinterpretations of the user rights regarding fair use. We have just talked about it in the previous talks. And also an escape from political control towards organizations that are not democratic at all. In order to reach a clean state of irreversibility. And as we were saying yesterday, we could see that as an analogy and compare it to what happened at the very end of the royalty period in France. It's a pre-revolutionary rigidification where there from the basis in order to change the system, because we are experiencing new ways to create wealth, new ways of using our power. And so there is the trying to bolt the cover on it. But the more they bolt, the more it will explode, and it's a bit frightening. I would like the lows to pass more softly, but clearly we are going to experience a really harsh period. And so I consider this as a threat to the blossoming of new models of producing and trading information goods, with the reappearance on the notion of commons, which has been completely destroyed by the past and still ongoing ideology of financial capitalism and individualism. And so we are really at the very edge of history, in my point. And the proceedings of YPO, if it's all about intellectual. Well, you have bunches of people here from different organizations. There are several people here dealing with software patents within Euronet and out of Euronet in this room. There are people, you know, who think about the Creative Commons. And the idea of the commons is structuring at the time being, and many organizations are small bunch of individuals, but now, according to the ongoing threat, they are also in reaction going to federate and meet. I mean, not later than last Tuesday, I also met new people with whom I made connections. I mean, yeah, but you have to find them through the internet. I mean, put the right keywords, you find the right sites. But even out of the software field, if you look at the patenting on genes, you have something about Miriam. time is that we are on a lobbying process. And if we had come to the European Parliament saying, okay, we want to crush the entire patent system because it has gone mad, that wouldn't have worked as we indeed partly succeeded. So we must go on step by step. Here we have a chance because, I mean, it's very clear. The economical facts are so obvious. You can show so obviously that it's not a good idea to have software patents, but it's maybe the first time when you can make people think that the one size fits all model of patents may not be applicable. And if we succeed in winning this, I mean, the wave will go backwards, I think. Yes? Yeah, but there are two things that I can oppose to that. This is what I said in my speech. The number of algorithms you have in order to get, for instance, the arrival date starting date and speed. I mean, you will not be able to use the age of the driver within the equation. I mean, you will have no other algorithm. Yeah, absolutely. And the second point, which is interesting because I'm fighting lawyers from Philips, but very interestingly, Philips was a company that blossomed in Netherlands when Netherlands scrapped their patent system. Because else it would have been sued by Edison. And if you look at it, I mean, for instance, there has been a memo by Bill Gates, a memo dating back to 1991, maybe where some of you know it. It's an internal memo where he gives his strategical advice for the upcoming year. And so in 1991, he realized about the patents, he read about them, and said, well, if there had been patents by the time the computer science grew, we would be at the complete standstill today. But then, since he was a small guy and knew that Microsoft was dominating, he said, son, no, we must patent as much as we can. And indeed, Microsoft did it. I mean, they filed more than 2,800 software patents last year, European patents. Not all of them have been granted, but if you boot a computer with a CD-ROM, you will be infringing on a Microsoft patent in some years. Okay. This is why we haven't seen much infringement lawsuits in Europe, because now people can be opposed to the 1973 European Patent Convention in court to say, no, your patent is invalid because of this. It's not even a matter of prior art, it's not even a matter of lack of inventiveness or lack of technical content. There is the text. And so they want also in some amendments to the directive, there was also articles that said that the European Patent Convention should also be rewritten. because they are snags. I mean, software should not be patented according to the 1973 European Patent Convention, and they found technical enough the Tamagotchi. So I'm assured that whatever restrictions they put on the text, they will be circumvented by lawyers in order to grant the proper patents. Because they don't want to make it clear. For instance, we at Eurolinux were able to have some amendments drafted and put to vote in the industry committee. And for instance, we had one amendment that clearly defined the notion of technicity, which said that was considered technical something that involved the use of controllable forces of nature. That is, there should be a material substratum, or even light, matter. But in order for it to be an invention, it must have a material part. And McCarthy and the others voted against, willfully, because they know that this is the principal nexus. And this is the hole in the text within which they will be able to patent everything once the text is voted. This is the whole point. The notion of technicity is the core, is the core point of the text. Once you define technicity, I can vote for the text, but I won't vote for a text that does not define technicity, because it says yes to patents without any restriction on the definition of technicity, and it creates more juridical uncertainty, because else it would be the courts which would have to decide on a case-by-case basis what is technical and what is not, and judges are overworked and can be easily overturned. Which one, dear? Okay. Which? Show them the patent. Yeah, absolutely. It's like for the report, they just read the abstract and the conclusion. But you should look, show them the pattern, say, okay, software is not patentable. What about the Tamagotchi patent? What about the cooking recipes patent? Okay, patterns. So tell me, you think that any legislation that has allowed that and it is now enforced as directive will do better than what the EPO did? So show them the patterns. I've given you enough material for you to go to your representatives and do the job. Did you plan to go to Oliver's?
I'm not sure.